From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Senator Gary Peters on the impeachment proceedings underway in the nation's capital.
We have to make sure we send a clear message to any future president that this type of behavior is simply unacceptable to the American people, and they will be held accountable.
And we'll find out how Michigan's job numbers are doing.
The restaurants and hospitality business, they purged about 47% of all of their jobs.
Plus, the workers hardest hit by job loss and childcare have been women. We'll talk with one business owner, elected leader, and mother of four who's balancing everything.
You know, now more than ever, we need leaders that will help us. And that's really what it is about, being a public servant and helping others.
Those stories coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, how women in Michigan have been weathering the pandemic. They're among the hardest hit by job loss and the child care needs crippling the state's workforce.
My kids are my number one priority, and they need me. So I feel like, you know, even though I try to balance the store and my kids, they always come first, and the store is secondary.
We'll talk to one working mom who's also holding down elected office later in the program. But first, the second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump is underway as the Senate begins to set parameters for the proceedings. Joining us now is Senator Gary Peters, Democrat from Michigan. Fresh off re-election and the sea change in the Senate, he's also the incoming chair of the Senate Homeland Security Committee. Senator Peters, welcome back to Stateside.
Well, great to be with you.
So now that the U.S. Senate is on a pretty even partisan split, Democrats need all the votes they can to convict and an additional 17 Republicans to join the caucus. It's unclear if more than five or so Republicans are entertaining the idea of vote to convict at this point. What is the right argument to make in your estimation about why they should vote to impeach the leader of their own party?
Well, I think it's very clear. The facts are very clear that you had a president of the United States basically inciting an insurrection and an attack on the United States Capitol, a violent attack on the United States Capitol, something that we have not seen a U.S. president ever do. It's simply unacceptable. It needs to be called out, and the former president now needs to be held accountable for that behavior. And it's important for us to do that because we have to make sure we send a clear message to any future president that this type of behavior is simply unacceptable to the American people, and they will be held accountable.
I know that Senator Patrick Leahy was set to preside over the impeachment trial, but he was admitted to a hospital last night, not feeling well. Do you know anything more about his health and whether he plans to continue overseeing the proceedings?
Well, I understand he was released last night, and he's doing well. And at least what I don't have any up-to-date information, but what I heard last, that he has every intent to continue to move forward, that he's okay. And we keep praying to make sure that that's the case.
Glad to hear he's all right. Republican Senator Rand Paul this week forced a vote on the constitutionality of the impeachment process. Not to confuse the Senate with the U.S. Supreme Court, but he was basically asking if the trial should go forward since Donald Trump is no longer president. What we learned from that vote is that there are 45 senators who agreed with Rand Paul that it's not constitutional. And so the two-thirds majority that would be needed in the Senate is unlikely. Knowing that, is it worth going through with the impeachment trial anyway?
It is for the reasons that I mentioned. We have to be very clear that this is not something that is acceptable. And, you know, I think it's interesting that the Republicans are not arguing the facts. I think they realize the facts are terrible, that you have a president who started immediately after the election, basically putting out a big lie, that the election was stolen despite having no evidence whatsoever. And it was very clear as the days and weeks went by, there was no evidence of widespread fraud. And yet we had a president that continued to put that information out. And unfortunately, far too many elected Republican officials were putting out that information out as well, refused to acknowledge the truth. And when they were doing that, they were undermining the very foundation of our democracy, which is that we have fair and free elections. It is a dangerous talk they were engaged in right after the election. I was very outspoken by the fact that they continue to put out these falsehoods, continue to stoke anger, and that this was very dangerous behavior on the part of Republicans. And clearly that played out, because that's exactly what happened. This dangerous rhetoric led to violence and an attack on the very citadel of our democracy, the United States Capitol. People died, folks were injured. And I think I speak for all Americans who are watching that happen. As folks were watching it, it wasn't just an attack on the men and women who work in the Capitol. It was truly an attack on our country, and it was an attack on all Americans. And so this is outrageous behavior. We need to call it out. We need to move forward. And they're making a process argument that, quite frankly, makes no sense. It defies common sense that someone who could be engaged in that behavior, and then if they simply resign or leave, that they are not held accountable. It's actually against precedent. The Congress in the past has impeached folks, even though they try to resign before impeachment. If they were guilty of basically criminal behavior while they were holding that office, they can be subject to an impeachment. And part of that impeachment process is not just the removal of office. It's also the fact that they can never again run for federal office because of the behaviors that they were engaged in.
You're now chairing the Senate's Homeland Security Committee, which had been overseeing hearings on election integrity under then-chair Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. Are you planning to continue with those hearings?
Well, we will continue to do hearings on a variety of threats to the homeland security, although right now my focus is dealing with the pandemic and our oversight responsibilities of FEMA, and that's to make sure the vaccine distribution is done more efficiently and that it's truly a national response. We have to get the vaccine into more arms and as quickly as possible. We need to push that aggressively through committee hearings and the oversight function. We also have to deal with cybersecurity threats. The government was just hit with a major and very damaging cyber attack by a state actor. We have to fortify those defenses. And we also have to deal with the rise of domestic terrorism and white supremacy in particular, something that has to be addressed. Despite efforts of mine over the last few years, no surprise, the Trump administration was simply unwilling to deal with the rise of white supremacist groups and domestic terrorism. That will be a focus of mine as chair of Homeland Security.
In other news, we hear that Majority Leader Schumer is likely to name you soon as chair of the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee. It's traditional for people in closely divided regions to hold this position. But I wanted to ask you, there are some progressives who want to see the Senate handled differently now. When you think ahead to the 2022 election and what Democrats could be doing right now to strengthen their position to pick up more Senate seats and possibly expand the majority in the Senate, do you think Democrats should treat the 50 seats like 60 seats and just go full steam ahead on agenda?
Well, there's no question that we have to make sure that we show to the American people that we're able to get things done in a way that helps everybody across our country. We've got to have a record of accomplishment. Right now, our number one focus has to be to get through this pandemic as quickly as possible. We have seen firsthand the mismanagement from the Trump administration. We are in much worse shape than we should be, given the lack of competence that we saw from the Trump administration. So I'm certainly focused to make sure that President Biden and his very aggressive posture to deal with this this virus moves forward. And we have to demonstrate clearly to the American people that when Democrats have the reins of control, that we are competent and we're able to get things done as quickly as possible.
I know we have less than a minute to go, but this week brought so much very interesting news for the 2022 Senate races. And one piece of this is very close to home. Republican Rob Portman of Ohio is not running for re-election. Do you think that a second Democratic senator can win in Ohio, given that the state went for Donald Trump in the last two elections, and that the governor's office has been under Republican control since 2010?
Well, I think there's always opportunities to win seats, particularly if you're demonstrating to the American people that we have an agenda that makes a difference in their lives. And always an open seat is always one that presents more opportunities than one with an incumbent.
Are there candidates you have an eye on in Ohio?
I think there'll be a number of candidates that will come forward in the days and weeks ahead.
Do Democratic candidates in places like Ohio and Arizona have a chance if President Biden can't get his COVID agenda moved forward?
Well, I think right now I'm focused on getting the COVID agenda moving forward because the American people need it. We have folks who are still struggling to put food on the table, a roof over their head. We've got small businesses that are struggling to stay open. And there's no way we can get this economy up and running as quickly as any of us would like if our small businesses aren't able to survive. So our focus has to be on good policy. And good policy means working aggressively to get people on their feet and through this pandemic.
Senator Peters, thank you for your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
You may have seen President Biden's two German Shepherds, Champ and Major, are moving into the White House this week. The world of dog lovers has reason to celebrate as the return of canine companions to the White House continues a longstanding tradition broken by President Trump, who joined James Polk, president in 1845, as the only other president without a pet in the official residence. When it comes to Michigan's claim on presidential dogs, President Gerald Ford had an often photographed golden retriever named Liberty, who came to the White House as just a puppy and who had a litter of her own puppies while Ford was president. Liberty joined a succession of golden retrievers owned by the Ford family. Indeed, Jerry Ford said they were very partial to the friendly family breed. That may not be a surprise to Michiganders, as golden retrievers have remained one of the most popular dogs in the state over all these years. Personally, even as a cat person, I get it. There is not a sector of Michigan's economy that hasn't been hit by the COVID pandemic. In just a few minutes, job numbers in Michigan. Crane's Detroit business reporter Dustin Walsh stops by to give us the good, the bad, and the ugly.
I feel like we're at this weird inflection point where people like myself are sort of bouncing between optimism and deep sadness about the future.
We'll be right back after a short break. This is Stateside.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Tonight, Governor Whitmer delivers her third State of the State address. This one, a bit different than we're used to. It'll be held away from the Capitol and with no lawmakers or other guests in attendance. Probably a fitting change for the year that we've had. And it also reflects a lot of somber news that the governor will have to deliver as she recounts the deep human and economic toll that the COVID pandemic has taken on Michigan. One of the most pressing stories of the past year has been the sheer loss of jobs, the unemployment benefit claims, and what we consider in our society to be essential services or service workers. Dustin Walsh of Crane's Detroit has been doing some reporting on the confluence of all these things, and he joins us now. Dustin, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks, April.
Okay, give it to us straight. What are the hard numbers as of this month when we look at the loss of jobs in Michigan?
Oh, well, okay. No one wants to feel good today. We lost about 480,000 jobs last year in 2020, which was remarkable. You know, it was not a good year. About a little more than 200,000 of those were in the kind of the restaurants and hospitality business, which is sort of be expected. They purged about 47% of all of their jobs. So it's not been a good year. Manufacturing lost 36,000 jobs. There hasn't been any industry that hasn't been touched really by the kind of the COVID pandemic when you cut through sort of all of the industries together. So it's not a great picture for the future, but you know, hopefully things are looking brighter.
In your reporting, you've also discussed something that might seem out of place with joblessness, and that's an increase in union membership. How do those two issues run in parallel with each other, or do they?
Right. It's sort of confounding, right? We've had this just mass loss of jobs, and yet union membership grew year to year. I mean, union membership for the last, you know, few decades has been pretty hit or miss. It rises and goes down, but you certainly wouldn't expect with, you know, nearly 500,000 jobs lost for membership to go up. But what happened is really sort of a several fold thing here. You know, one is that it's the industries that typically are heavy union didn't lose as many jobs. Yes, manufacturing lost over 60,000 jobs combined with trade. But really, we saw a lot of those people kind of, especially in the retail, in the restaurant industries that typically are not union, those lost lots and lots of jobs. And those people all had to find work, whether it be work share programs or whatever else. And they picked up work in a lot of different areas, whether that was in food service, you know, where it was like a meatpacking industry, these places that were in high demand, or particular Meijer and Kroger. Mm. You know, we've all spent way, way more money on groceries this year than we had in the past because we're not dining out. And those are all union heavy industries, actually.
So is there any indication of how unions are feeling about this surge of sorts that's happening?
Well, they're obviously thrilled that they've picked up more members, right? A higher unionship representation is good for if you're a union. But they're not optimistic that it's a long-term growth. All those jobs were sort of filled this year. You know, being able to sustain that is not likely next year unless they can start organizing, right? Like start finding manufacturing plants, maybe foreign manufacturing plants that are operating in the U.S. that are not union, that they can turn union. They haven't had a lot of success with that in probably the last 15 years. So the odds of rising union membership as we go forward is probably pretty slim.
Well, what about the things that they might have been able to do for members? Have there been any increases in better wages for unions, benefits, or anything else that they might be negotiating for?
Right. So we haven't seen a lot of that yet. You know, that data is usually pretty lagged. But yes, typically if the rises in union membership typically means rises in wages, and they do have a spillover effect. So when union members make more money, typically the non-union members tend to go up, right? It's trying to kind of bridge the gap because there is a massive disparity between union jobs and non-union jobs as far as wages go. So we're sort of seeing, you know, that confluence will help. And also, you know, minimum wage is a big topic. We saw yesterday that the Biden administration and others want to make the federal minimum wage $15 an hour. That does have spillover effects. It's not a lot of people that make below that, surprisingly, but it does have spillover effects that would, you know, possibly raise wages around other industries.
Yeah, this has been kicking around for a while now. Have the business community gotten anywhere near this subject? Has the business community started to talk about what Biden is proposing, given the financial hardships everyone is facing?
Right. I think when you're taking in this microcosm of COVID-19 or what we hope to be microcosm, you know, please end this thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of a harder take, right? Looking at what $15 minimum wage looks like. The business community has weighed in the past prior to COVID mainly, but you know, their issue is always, it's a difficult place to be in depending on where you're at. If you look at restaurant workers, obviously they don't make $15 an hour. They make well below minimum wage. So maybe your mom and pop diners, maybe that's a good thing for those workers. But for workers that work at, you know, maybe some of the fancier higher end restaurants, going to that minimum wage and getting rid of their tips is what they always kind of suspect would happen. They view that as a negative because they make well above $15 an hour at some of these places when you include their tips based on what people are tipping on their meals.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to other places, it's other economists, other people see it as maybe a potential advantage for large companies like Target, Amazon, that already pay this amount of money. And now you're taking smaller companies that are trying to compete with these massive, massive companies. And now they can't, you know, now their wages are so high, it's hard for them to compete, you know, on a kind of dollar for dollar level. And then also talking about rural America, right? So it's harder to pay $15 an hour, maybe in Nagani in Michigan's Upper Peninsula versus Metro Detroit. So those things all kind of weigh in. And when you do a national minimum wage, those issues all matter, especially when you're talking from state to state. You know, there's a big difference between Mississippi and Michigan. So those all the issues are there. They're obviously talking about it. But again, it's a smaller portion. It's growing a smaller portion every day. $15 an hour by 2025, which I believe was the date they put on it. There's not going to be a lot of workers left at $15 an hour at 2025, in my speculation. You know, it'll help some, but overall, it's not as big of a deal then as people kind of make it out to be.
For sure. Dustin, hey, I know you report on business, not on politics, but these two often get mixed up with each other. What will you be listening for when Governor Whitmer makes her State of the State address tonight?
Well, I think it depends. I mean, I think there's going to be a little blustering and she's going to have to do positioning on sort of the economic shutdowns and keeping things closed. And you know, she's come under attack probably correctly about sort of where the math is on this stuff, because it's hard to move beyond what's arithmetic and what's, you know, suspicion. But I think the way forward is what I'll be looking for and what businesses are going to be looking for. Like, what does an economic reopening look like? Even though, again, we're mostly open, but I think restaurants, you know, can only avoid this for so long, and they're supposed to open on February 1st. Does that help schools? I mean, there's just a lot of uncertainty, and I'm not sure she's going to have the answer. The governor's going to have the answer to that. But I think people are going to be looking for optimism is another aspect that they'll be looking for. I feel like we're at this weird inflection point where people like myself are sort of bouncing between optimism and deep sadness about the future of this country and of, you know, the state and just our lives, right? Mm-hmm. So I think people would be looking for some optimism. And I think business, if you look at what's going on in business community, I think that things are getting a little more optimistic. Different organizations and different things are projecting maybe a faster turnaround than we were thinking maybe over the summer. So, you know, maybe by the end of this year, things will look a lot better than maybe, you know, in well into 2022, which were the original projections, you know, 5 months ago. So hopefully, you know, a level of optimism is going to kind of sweep around, but we'll see.
Dustin, we've talked more than once in the past about the sectors of the workforce that have been hardest hit during the pandemic. And you've noted that people of color and women have really been hit hard in terms of job loss outright, but also in terms of just all the things that are happening to squeeze the kind of sectors that people are in. And I just wondered, have you noticed any substantial changes in people's lives as you keep talking to workers and businesses about what's going on right now?
Right. I think you're sort of seeing two different avenues that are going. I think you're seeing companies, particularly larger companies, which have been getting larger every year, and more people work for these larger companies. They're doing changes. They've seen the things that people have gone through. They're seeing sort of the impact on women, particularly throughout the pandemic, having to, you know, the childcare unreasonably falling on women, et cetera, et cetera. I think you're going to see more parental leave things going into effect. I think you'll see more flexibility in the workspace. So I think there's going to be some outright benefits, particularly for women in corporate jobs. But as we know, a lot of women do not work in those jobs. A lot of women do work in the industries that have been negatively impacted by COVID-19 and the shutdowns. So it's hard to understand where that's going to be. I don't think those jobs are necessarily going to get better. Childcare will remain a massive issue in this country. It's getting more and more expensive every day because of relatively prohibitive. Basically, we wanted to protect children, so we put in some prohibitive licensing requirements, which was great because it helped, you know, bad ones go out of business, but it also put good ones out of business. So a lot of in-home daycares are closing, and a lot of big, fancy, very, very expensive daycares are opening. And daycare is going to squeeze earnings for a lot of people. And that's going to basically putting the situation on women where they're going to have to make the decision of whether they work or whether they stay home with the children. Because you got to make a lot of money to be able to afford to send your kids to daycare, particularly if you have multiple children. And so that decision has to be made whether it's more cost effective to just stay home or to send them to daycare. Those are long-term issues that existed before COVID that are just being really highlighted. And I'm not sure they're all going to be solved, but, you know, at least people are more aware of them, you know, now.
Dustin Walsh of Cranes Detroit. Dustin, thank you so much. I'm looking forward to the day when we can come at you for some better news.
Oh, me too. Thank you.
We so appreciate having you tune in for Stateside every day. But we'd love to actually hear from you, too. Let us know what's going on in your corner of the state and maybe some stories that we might be missing. You can also connect with other listeners and Stateside staff about the show. There are a couple of places to find us. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Also, you can find us on Facebook on the Michigan Radio page or send us an email. Our address is stateside@michiganradio.org. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Job loss during COVID-19 has been a pandemic in and of itself, with millions of people all over the world finding themselves at home instead of traveling to work every day. And among the industries hardest hit are food service, hospitality, childcare, and retail. In America and in Michigan, these are the industries where many women make their bread and butter, especially women of color. For Macomb County Commissioner and mother of four, Mai Zong, it's her retail business, Mai & Company, that's seen significant transformation during the pandemic. Mai, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, April. Thank you for having me.
First of all, how's your family doing?
We're hanging in there. It's like a party every day at my house with four kids.
You're not kidding. I think they're pretty young, too. All of them under the age of 7?
8, actually. So I have a 2, 4, 6, and 8-year-old, 2 boys and 2 girls.
Yeah, handful doesn't really seem to cover it.
Yes, I wanted a big family. And then, you know, after I had my 4th child, I said I was done.
Well, tell me a little bit about the shop. You sell clothes and home goods that use some really gorgeous textiles inspired by traditional Hmong style. Who's been in your customer base over the years?
Sure. I started Mai & Co. out of my home, actually, in Warren. I was pregnant with my daughter, who's 2 now. And the clothing that I design, I illustrate all the patterns, and they are based on traditional Hmong textiles, which is my ethnicity. Our customer base are mainly Hmong American women who are very much like myself, very modern and have children and have careers and also want to express, you know, their culture and their history. And so our clothing, it's meant to be very comfortable and modernized as opposed to like the traditional Hmong clothing that we would, you know, traditionally wear that's very heavy and very fancy. And so it's hard to wear those type of garments every day. But my & Co., we offer apparel that is made for the modern Hmong American woman.
Right. More suitable for doing the work and recreational things that clothes have to endure. Before the pandemic started, did you have people working for you?
I did. And we were doing very well. I mean, we had, you know, we opened up our store in Warren on 12 Mile last August. And, you know, the feedback was overwhelming. We had, you know, a lot of people come in and try on the clothes. But then, you know, after the pandemic, things really slowed down. People were afraid to come out.
Do you remember a point at which you knew that 2020 was going to be different for your business?
Absolutely. So after the holiday season in December 2019, you know, we had a wonderful, busy holiday shopping season. Right after that, things really slowed down. And for me, it was very calming because I was very overwhelmed with opening the store and just with the children. But I knew early on in January that things were going to be different and they were going to be much slower in terms of the foot traffic in our store. And so this was even way before the pandemic had hit. Things had already started to slow down.
What changes did you have to make to keep some semblance of the business alive?
Well, we had to shut down in mid-March, obviously, because of the executive order. And we didn't open back up until June. So we were closed for about 3 months. And between that time, we tried our best to fulfill our orders online. So we were trying to revamp our website, our social media presence, and to let our customers know that, hey, you know, we're still operating, even though our store was closed. So we managed to do that. And then in the process, I remember the first week when the store was shut down and my children were out of school in mid-March. We spent a week together. I just didn't know. I felt useless almost, like I wasn't doing anything because I'm so used to, you know, creating and working. And so I actually went back to the store, got all my fabric and my sewing machine, and I started sewing face masks. Part of it was because there were none available. And I felt like if I had to go to the grocery store, I didn't have anything. And so I started making face masks for my kids and for myself and for my family. And so we sort of incorporated the handmade face masks using the illustrations and the patterns that I design and making very unique face masks. So that's how we've been getting by, is offering that product, which, you know, we wouldn't have done that if it weren't for the pandemic. That became a necessity, and now it's just a part of our business.
Yeah. You know, having four kids at home is not a small part of the equation. Did the time when the store initially closed buy you some time to figure out what you were going to do at home?
Absolutely. I mean, when the store was open, you know, my two older kids that are in elementary school, they were in school. And so I had the two younger ones with me and they were always running around the store. And so I knew that it wouldn't be safe for me to have them at the store, even when it opened back up, just with people coming in. And so I've had to sort of take a step back and reevaluate how to manage the, you know, the business and be a mom. And thankfully, you know, I have a very small team of staff who help, you know, run the store and do the fulfillment and managing the website, that I can spend time helping my kids with their schoolwork. So that's what I've been doing most days. In the morning, I'll answer, you know, emails from customers and help manage the staff. But my kids are my number one priority and they need me. So I feel like, you know, even though I try to balance the store and my kids, they always come first and the store is secondary.
We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Mai Zong about keeping work and family going during the pandemic and what could be different about how we're doing this. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We're talking today with Mai Zong. In addition to holding a seat on the Macomb County Board of Commissioners, she's juggling her retail business, Mai & Co., and the care of her four children. She's one of so many Michigan women on the front line of the pandemic's economic crash. Let's get back to our conversation. Have there been days when you just wish there were some way to close the door on one thing or the other, or just scale back in some way?
Absolutely. I think about that almost every day, that am I doing too much? Am I not spending enough time with my kids? And should I, you know, should I be helping them with their schoolwork? But then I want the business I want so much for it to succeed, because it has. And so I don't want to stop. And, you know, earlier in January, when I knew the holiday season was over, I had filed to run for local office. And that was something that I always wanted to do after I had kids and, you know, as an established business. It just felt like the time was right. And so I was actually anticipating that we would be slowing down in January, just not so significantly to where we were shut down. And so I had allowed myself that time to campaign and to run for office. But it's hard. It's hard juggling all three parts of my life. And, you know, during the summertime when the store was closed, I had my kids with me and I had my wagon. I was pulling them. I was door knocking. I took the kids everywhere. And, you know, anyone who saw me saw that I had four kids trailing behind me. And it's hard, but I don't want to give up and I don't want to stop the momentum that we had started.
So I think the question that probably all our listeners want answered right now is, when do you sleep?
I sleep when the kids sleep, actually. They go to sleep about 9:30. I go to sleep too. And I wake up in the morning around 9 in the morning. And, you know, the kids are, my husband helps me out a lot, though. He wakes the kids up. He gets them ready for their online class. And so I don't do this alone. I have a lot of help.
Is there anything that you're able to do for yourself right now just to preserve a little bit of sanity?
You know, ironically enough, it's the designing and it's the sewing that is very therapeutic for me. And so even though I'm, you know, creating things, I'm still able to have that time to do what I love, and that is to create things, and I'm very hands-on. And so when I'm sewing, or if I'm, you know, drawing or making a new illustration, that's my time. And I enjoy that so much. So that's enough for me to keep going.
Have you heard other stories from women working in Macomb County about how their lives have changed over the past year?
I have. And as a commissioner now, you know, talking to my neighbors and my constituencies, I hear that all the time. There are a lot of women who have young children like me who are, you know, struggling to hold on to their career or even start a career. and just other businesses like restaurants in my area that I have, you know, talked to the owners. I think everyone is going through a very difficult time right now.
Are there ways that this year has influenced your ideas about what public service can do in a time like this?
Absolutely. I think the pandemic has really highlighted the racial and economic disparities in our communities. And so we, you know, now more than ever, we need leaders that will help us. And that's really what it is about, being a public servant and helping others, because so many rely on those, you know, types of assistances.
What are some things that you think the county has done and could further do to help women, especially maybe women of color and women who are living on the lower end of the economic spectrum?
I think that, you know, helping with early childhood education and childcare, that would be the number one thing. And myself, as a mom with young children, you know, it's hard to be able to catch up to someone else who doesn't have, you know, children, or if their kids are older, it's really hard for someone like me to catch up. And so, you know, we definitely need to build a support system to support all women and children.
I imagine that through your older kids, you've had a chance to experience what's going on in schools and how some districts are trying to help younger children at a distance. What do you observe of their needs right now?
Sure. Well, I can say, you know, even before the pandemic, it was very difficult to afford childcare and to make arrangements. And so that was one of the main reasons why I decided to stay home, so that I could be with the kids and work from home and juggle a career and watching, you know, the kids. So the pandemic has just really amplified that. We now know, everyone knows, that it's very difficult as a parent with young children to be dealing with, you know, work and everyday life. And so I think now with the vaccine being available and teachers having that opportunity to, you know, be vaccinated, and we now are able to talk to our kids about the importance of, you know, washing their hands and practicing good social distancing and hygiene. I think it's just a process that we have sort of gone through during this pandemic that will help us get closer to where we want to be. And that is back to some sort of normalcy, and our kids in school, and having like a more of a consistent schedule. Because they, the kids need that as much as we do too, to work and to function.
Mai Zong, she's a member of the Macomb County Board of Commissioners and also the proprietor of Mai and Co. in Warren. Mai, it's great talking to you. Thank you so much for making a little time for us.
Thank you for having me.
Imagine being an essential worker through the entire pandemic, gainfully employed, but in a position that's very high stress. Your workplace is guarded by the police, though still vulnerable to shenanigans. And many of the decisions you make every week could be a matter of life and death. Oh, and you're pregnant with your first child in a male-dominated industry. If you can put yourself in these shoes, that's a brief description of State Senator Mallory McMorrow's pandemic life. And she joins us now. Senator McMorrow, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So your due date was 2 days ago. How are you doing?
My due date was 2 days ago, and I may or may not be in active early labor right now. So hopefully it's happening any day now.
As we speak.
As we speak. Yeah. There was some signs this morning where I'm like, okay, this could be it, but I don't want to be overly optimistic about it. So it might be happening.
I mean, there's a part of me that hopes that by the time people are hearing this, that the whole process might be over and done with.
I hope so as well. She has overstayed her welcome. She's very comfortable, but we are ready for her to make her appearance in the world.
We really appreciate your making time for us to talk right now.
Yeah. it's a good distraction.
It's not unheard of for lawmakers to be pregnant while in office, but kind of uncommon. And given the fact that most of our state lawmakers are men, and a fair number of those who are women are a little bit older, Do you feel like you are in a supportive environment to work to see you through this juggling act?
Yeah, it's been really interesting. You know, I when I was elected, I learned that I was the youngest woman ever elected to the Senate in Michigan in my early 30s. And that is true. There aren't that many working moms in the legislature. I'm very grateful to have Stephanie Chang as a colleague who I've been able to ask questions, but it's made it very apparent that this is not a space that is designed for moms and working moms and really anybody who's a caretaker of anybody, which is so many people throughout our state are taking care of kids or parents or loved ones. And it's been a very eye-opening experience.
Are there ways in which just the physical space of the Capitol seems different to you now?
There's a lot of steps. I'm relatively active. I like to stay active, but, you know, we break from session and we go into caucus and it's up three or four flights of stairs. And it takes me a little while to get there versus some of my colleagues. Yeah, it's definitely changed the physical experience and the commute. You know, I'm 86 miles one way from Royal Oak to Lansing. So it's a lot of time in the car.
Likewise, are there ways in which maybe policy issues have a different feel for you now that you might otherwise have thought a bit less about?
Yeah, they certainly do. You know, I think that everybody brings their own lived experience to the legislature. And I've long been a vocal advocate of the fact that we need elected officials who are representative of the people we represent. And when the majority of those in elected office are older, tend to be a little bit wealthier white men, we've seen policy that reflects that. So it is changing the way that I think about policy, especially as we're going through a pandemic. You know, I'm thinking about every mom who's been at home for the past year trying to juggle working and being at home with kids and trying to help them with online learning and just how many holes there are. And we've seen some of those reports that the total job losses, I think, you know, a month or 2 months ago, were made up entirely of women. So it is definitely going to change how I approach policy. And I think that's a good thing.
There was a point earlier this year in which you were one of the state lawmakers speaking out after the demonstrations in late April at the Capitol, in which a lot of armed protesters were milling in and about the Capitol building. And, you know, since then, we've seen a bit of a pivot in the way the issue is being handled, partly because of what happened January 6th at the U.S. Capitol. I do know, though, that the restrictions that you had hoped for on guns more broadly maybe have not gotten the traction that they would have otherwise. Do you think that there will be appetite to further legislate gun restrictions in the coming months?
You know, it's interesting and a little bit heartbreaking. I watched the events unfold on January 6th in the U.S. Capitol, and it just felt so familiar. You know, it was horrifying to watch, but I think any of us who lived in the Senate chamber in Michigan on April 30th, the year prior, it felt like a dry run, and it wasn't surprising to see what was happening at the U.S. Capitol. But the U.S. Capitol does not allow firearms, doesn't allow any weapons, doesn't allow water bottles. You know, there's a pretty strict list of prohibited items to ensure that the United States Capitol is a safe place for everybody who works there and attendees. And obviously, those safety measures were not in place on the 6th, but they do exist otherwise. And in this current climate, it is terrifying to think of what would have happened. And I even look back on April 30th, I stayed on the Senate floor when there were four men heavily armed carrying rifles behind my head. And looking back, I probably shouldn't have sat there because it would only take one person putting their finger on a trigger to change everything. So I didn't know that I was pregnant yet, but I have been, and there have been subsequent demonstrations at the Capitol, and it has changed my thinking about it, certainly.
You alluded to this a little bit, but we've read and heard many times in recent months about how disproportionately the pandemic is affecting the women in Michigan who work. There have been greater losses in jobs, greater losses in wages. Do you think now, having spent some time thinking about this, are there targeted ways that the legislature might try to do something about this in the relief packages that are under construction?
Absolutely. You know, I think that despite the fact that we are in 2021, I think that a lot of the emotional labor, the caring labor, the soft labor still falls on the back of women. Traditional gender roles are still very real. And many women like myself choose to do both, right? Choose to work and raise a family. And I think that's a good thing for our state and our economy and our country as a whole. But we need to evolve our policies to support that. You know, I talk a lot about the traditional 9-to-5 Monday through Friday work day. Just the fact that if you get out of an office at 5 p.m., but your kid gets out of school at 2, what do you do for those 3 hours? Is that something that we can support via legislation to possibly take some of the good things from this pandemic, more flexible work environments, more flexible schedules, and allow for that while still allowing women who work to be considered full-time to receive benefits? Obviously addressing the childcare gap that we saw during the pandemic that prevented many people from going back to work because their kids were at home. And ensuring that people have earned paid sick leave, which is something that, you know, Michigan voters put on the ballot in and was gutted by the legislature. So there's so many things that we can do to support not only women, but families, and just evolve the way that we think about work and work-life balance.
How do you think childcare is viewed by some of your colleagues across the aisle? Having had the year that we've had, do you think that you'd be able to find some consensus on something that could change the equation?
You know, I hope so. And it's interesting because the women that I serve with on the other side of the aisle are older. Their kids are grown. But everybody else on the other side of the aisle, if they do have kids or grandkids, it's been their wives or granddaughters who have stayed at home with them. And I will be very candid. There are some of my Republican colleagues who, for whatever reason, didn't talk to me very much before I got pregnant, and then checked in and wanted to see how I was doing. And it was a very strange feeling because it felt like I was suddenly valuable because I was pregnant, not because I was their colleague. So that's been emotionally a challenging thing to grapple with, especially with how hard I work to get into the Senate. But I hope that childcare is not viewed as less than, you know, the entirety of the continuation of our population of the human race is dependent on women. And we don't treat that with enough respect. It is treated as secondary. And we have to change that. And I think that only changes by changing who represents us in elected office.
Well, tonight, of course, is the night when another working mom in Lansing, Gretchen Whitmer, is going to deliver her State of the State speech. Is there anything particular you hope the governor will address?
Yeah, I mean, this has been a year like no other, and it is almost surreal to realize that a year ago we were all sitting shoulder to shoulder in the House chambers listening to last year's State of the State address, and that it's going to be virtual this year. You know, I've been a very vocal advocate since the beginning of the pandemic for evolving the way the legislature operates to allow for remote participation, remote voting. One of the things that has been a shock to me is that I am technically not a state employee. The legislature self-regulates itself, so I don't qualify technically for the maternity leave that the state provides. And if I miss a vote, you know, it turns into a campaign ad against me, which I'm preparing for. But, you know, I'm hoping that she addresses head on. You know, the only way we get through this, the only way that we return to normal is by addressing COVID-19 head on. Increasing vaccination, improving the way that people get in line to get vaccinated. I know it's been a rough rollout, but we're dependent on what comes to us from the federal level. And doing that with a sensitivity that this has been a terrible year for everybody. Every decision is a tough decision. And we're not each other's enemies. I think that that's going to be a theme that we hear from the governor. But I've just been watching what's been playing out in the legislature today with the majority GOP blocking every single appointment and now threatening to withhold education funding unless the governor relinquishes MDHHS's authority to handle the pandemic. And it makes me very worried for the next 2 years.
Senator Mallory McMorrow has been talking with us today. Mallory, we wish you all the best, and please enjoy your maternity time.
Thank you very much.
I'm April Baer. Thank you for being with us. We'll see you tomorrow.